morning, everyone. So last week, I think we came to our screeching halt with the Rashba, Rav Shlomo Ben Aderet. So let's pick it up like this. So what we identified, or what we tried to identify, is that there are significant traditions that are developing over the last 1,000 years in the study of Torah and the transmission of Torah. And we spoke about different areas. So we spoke about Tsarfas and Ashkenaz. So that would be this section of the map. We spoke about Spain, which would be over here. We spoke a little bit about Provence. So we began with the 11th century with Rabbeinu Gershom. We alluded to Rashi and then his grandson Rashban as one of the Baalei HaTosfos. We spoke about Rav Yah and Mordechai, the later Baalei HaTosfos, which is where we concluded with the tradition of Maharam and Rothenberg in the middle. And then on the Spanish side, we spoke about the Rif. We didn't really speak about the Rambam, although we mentioned that the Rif's student, the Rimi Gash, was the Rebbe of the Rambam's father. The Rashba was our last figure. And then we spoke a little bit about the Ravid from a Provençal standpoint. So today, we're going to pick up with number 8. We're going to be back in Ashkenaz. So if you look on the inside of the pink of the salmon, let's go with the salmon packet. If you look on the inside cover where the map is, look at number 3. So that's where you'll find Neustadt, which is a German city. You see where it is? Number 3. This brings us to Trumas Hadeshen, Rav Yisroel Isserlin. So he's living here, and he's here on our map. So it's about 14. What was it? When was he born? 1390. About 1460 he died. So this is a very important time because now he's living in Germany. In 1306, the Jews are expelled from France. So essentially, this is the big move, kind of the big shift of the Torah study from France over to Eastern Europe. So now we're making our way slowly. Okay, so Rav Yisroel Isserlin, he's going to quote many important sources from the Chachmei Ashkenaz from before, and he writes a series of responsa in his collection that we have in front of you called Trumas Hadeshen. The reason why his response is called Trumas Hadeshen, which means literally picking up the ashes, the garbage, in the Beis HaMikdash, is because he has 354 responsa, which is the numerical value of Deshen. Okay, it works. But what's additionally significant and interesting about these tshuvas, about these responsa, is that whereas in most cases, let's say last week we mentioned the Rashba got 3,000, 4,000 responsa, has 3,000, 4,000 questions. Those are questions that real people asked him. The Trumas Hadeshen didn't get asked that many questions, so he figured let's use the responsa literature, shelos and tshuvos, as a medium of teaching Torah. So he actually made up these questions, many of them. He asked them in the form of a question, even though they were never asked to him. So they're imaginary questions, but for the purpose of teaching. And he continues the tradition of the Chachmei Ashkenaz. Many of these are referred to as the Chassidei Ashkenaz, a highly pietistic and ascetic group of rabbinic figures over the last couple of hundred years that existed before him. So the question, the tshuva that I want to learn together today is a very important tshuva, and it's very lemaisa, so to speak. It's very practical. Asks the Trumas Hadeshen, Simon, if you look on the bottom, Umashika Safta, Simon Peches, 88, Od Me'aliyascha Le'eretz Tzvi. You asked me a question about the propriety of going on Aliyah to Eretz Tzvi. Eretz Tzvi is the nickname for Israel. What do you think, Rabbi Isserlin, living in the 15th century, about going on Aliyah? Is it a mitzvah? Is it recommended? Good question.
The Rambam said it.
So one second, we're not going to do a whole shiur. That's good. That's not for today. Thank you, doctor. Says the Trumas Hadeshen, look on the bottom right, look what he writes, very interesting. Dalacha, you should know, I'm on the second to last line on the right-hand column on Simon Peches. You should know, Dibavadai Shevach Gadol Umayla Yesh Lo Adam Hadar Be'eretz Yisrael. It's definitely very praiseworthy There's definitely something laudatory about living in Eretz Yisrael. V'kol shekein be'ir HaKodesh l'toelas l'olam haba v'gam l'olam hazeh. There's many spiritual benefits. And in this world, benefits of living, especially in Yerushalayim. Omnam. However, shamanu kama pa'am sheyesh l'sham b'nei bris me'arviyim nechshavim l'rishayim gemurim. You have to be careful. There are Jews who come from the West. We know them as Sephardim. Who we don't seem to get along very well with. Who are Rishoyim. Who have a practice of Mosrim Mufursamim. They are Moser people to the government. They cause a lot of problems. And this is beyond the scope of today's discussion. But for several centuries, there was a lot of tension between the Sephardic and Ashkenazic communities in Israel. So he says, this is a big problem. And they are Tordim umaval b'lim ho Ashkenazim shem shomrei Torah. They give the Ashkenazim a hard time. Gam also v'gam ki amazonos tochukim utzum samim. It's hard to make a living there. L'sham ma'od v'haravachim kashim. Business is difficult. Mi yuchal lamed b'cholzeh. Who can handle this? Top, turn the packet over. Milvad, forgetting about Godol Yirisha Sayishma'elim. Forget about the Arabs. Asher l'sham l'chein. Therefore, what's the psak about Aliyah? Kol ish yishayir ba'atzmo. Everybody needs to figure out for themselves. Bahasogas gufo umamono, with his personal and financial situation. Be'eze derech yuchal lamod b'yiras Hashem uveshimor mitzvosav kizeh kol ha'adam. Where can the person live their wholesome religious life better? Is it better to be in Israel, or is it better to be in America?
Sounds like an excuse.
What's that?
Sounds like an excuse.
That's one way to read it, or you could say it's being very realistic. Look, I can tell you that I've had many conversations with many great mentors of mine, including the late Gaon Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Hashem should shower us with the merit of Zechus Yagon Aleinu. So I spoke with Rav Lichtenstein at length about this question. I spoke to Rav Schwartz, Hashem should give him refuah shleima. I spoke to, there was once a Torah Mitzvah conference that I went to that Rav David Stav was at, and he basically gave a sicha to all the people who were there, all the fellows, and he told us that it's better to be a plumber in Israel than it is to be a mechanic in America. That's a bona fide opinion. So I sat with him at the dinner table, and I said, okay, let me share with you what's happening in Chicago, and you could tell me if you think that I should go become a plumber, although I think my wife will tell you for sure I should not be a plumber. That would not be, it's not recommended for anybody. But the thought, so he says, you know, you're right, okay. Not so simple that we should pick up tomorrow and go on Aliyah. So this tshuva of the Trumas Hadeshen speaks to the complexity of Aliyah and the real world issues that are involved in a very succinct manner, which I think is terrific.
He has also been. I mean, you can't compare.
Of course, like
now,
but the principle of the matter is what's interesting, and the principle is you have to know yourself,
right.
Which is what Rabbi Lichtenstein said to me. He said you have to know your family situation. You have to know where your parents are holding, where your in-laws are holding. Where, like, there's so many, and that's his point. He says you have to, you know, religious life is at the top of the mattering map for every one of us, every decision that we make. So it has to be at the top of the decision for Israel as well. Okay, let's move along, staying in the 14th century to Rav Yaakov ben Asher. So we're going to move back. We're going to move back here. This is Rosh, Rav Asher ben Yechiel, who was a chief disciple of Maharam of Rothenburg. Maharam of Rothenburg, we mentioned last time, was put in prison after he was captured. So his student, Rabbi Asher ben Yechiel, figures this is bad news. If they're trying to catch rabbis and get money out of them, so I'm going to get out of town. So he leaves Germany and he makes his way to Spain. He has a son when he's there. His name is Rav Yaakov ben Asher. So Rav Yaakov ben Asher is a significant rabbinic personality in Spain, which is why he's here. He's connected, you see, right near Rashba. He writes a commentary on the Chumash, which we have now. It's called the Baal HaTurim, but I didn't know until I read more about him in preparation. I didn't realize he wrote a whole commentary. The Baal HaTurim that we have is little gematrias, like little hints. He wrote a whole huge commentary, but for some reason nobody, I mean it's published somewhere, but nobody got into that. Everybody's just into the little mnemonics that he published. But what's more well known in his scholarly works, in addition to the fact that he wrote like a little commentary, a tiny, it's not really a commentary, it's more of a synopsis of the basic halachos that his father, Ravino Asher, ruled on. So he's living in Toledo. He writes the first quad section halachic work. Prior to him, we mentioned last week the Rif of Yitzchak Alfasi, the condensed halachic section of the Talmud. Then we have the Rambam. The Rambam wrote the 14 books. The Rush's son, Rabbeinu Yaakov, the Baal HaTur, the four columns, says, let's break it down into four sections. The first one is called Orach Chaim. That's basic Jewish living. That's for everybody. The second one is Yoredeo. So that's mostly mitzvos and kashrus and stuff like that, mostly for rabbis. And then Choshen Mishpat, civil law, and Evna Ezer, matrimonial law, that's mostly for dayanim, rabbinical judges. And that became the template for what's later known as the Shulchan Aruch, because Rav Yosef Karo, who authored the Shulchan Aruch, wrote a commentary on this tour, and he's like, wow, what a great way to break it up. So the tour, if you look on this page, the tour is in the middle section. This is Orach Chaim, but what you'll see in the tour on occasion is, even though that it is a strictly halachic work, sometimes you'll see like a little hint or a beautiful idea. So for example, here's a beautiful content, a piece of Torah from the tour, a concept that he hears from his brother. This is in Hilchos Rosh Chodesh, and the tour is pointing out that in Jewish tradition, the Rosh Chodesh, which Emir Tzashim, we're going to be celebrating this week, please God, on Wednesday and Thursday, it's a holiday to be celebrated by women. Rosh Chodesh is a women's holiday, and the question is why? Why is Rosh Chodesh a women's holiday in Jewish tradition? So he says, I'll tell you why. In the context of the laws of Rosh Chodesh, he says, I'll tell you why. I have a brother, his name is Yehuda. So he told me a nice pshat, and he wrote it down. He says here, in the bracket, V'shamati me'achi harav Yehuda tam ledavra. I'll tell you why. Lafisha hamoadim, because the holidays, the three major holidays, niskanu keneget, turn the packet, they are opposite ha'avos. They are opposite our forefathers. Pesach keneged, who would you say? Avraham. Dichsiv luji vasiu gos. We have a tradition that when Sarah baked the cakes, they were actually matzah, which just reminds you that matzah in the old days did not look like flat crackers. It looked like cakes. Shavuos keneged Yitzchak. Why? Shetkias shofar shel matan Torah hayu b'shofar me'elo shel Yitzchak. The Torah was given with the shofar blast. That shofar was from the Akedah. That's a tradition. So Shavuos is with Yitzchak. And then, fourth line on page Reish Samachay, Sukkos keneged Yaakov d'chsev l'mekneu asa sukkos. The Yud Beis Rosh Chodashim and the 12 Rosh Chodeshes, Shagam Haim Nikroi Moadim, they are also called Moed. Keneged, they are correlated to Yud Beis Shvatim, the 12 tribes. Ukeshachatu Be'egel, when the tribes did the sin of the golden calf, Nitlu Mehem, it was taken away from them, Venitnu Linishoseim, it was given to the wives. Why? Lazecher Shalo Hayu Ba'oso Chet. The women did not give to the Egel. And therefore, it was taken away from the tribes, and some suggest, in addition to this, that when was the Mishkan consecrated? Mishkan was consecrated on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Who gave very generously to the Mishkan? The women. And they did not give when it came to the Egel. And therefore, every Rosh Chodesh is a celebration, a reminder of the fact that the women were conscientious in terms of their religious observance. So that's just one, it's an example of kind of like an unusual something that you would find in a tour, but it's there, you'll find these kinds of things here and there. I wanted to move now to the 14th century, 1380 to 1444, in Spain, to another figure. We don't know so much about his life, although he was born in Aragon, and he was a student of Rav Chasdei Cresques. So if you look on our Spanish map over here, the Aragon is up here, Saragossa is right here. So he's living in this area, dominated by which religion? Christians. So two reasons. Number one, Even though originally, centuries before, there had been the Muslim conquest of the Iberian Peninsula, by now, by the 14th century, the Christians had reconquered the Iberian Peninsula. But even more than that, even when the Muslims had controlled much of Spain, this area in northern Spain was always heavily influenced by Christianity, because it borders, you see right up here is Narbonne, Perpignan, it borders France, which is the eldest daughter of the church. So this area was heavily Christian, and by now, by the 14th century, things are really strong in terms of Christian persecution, religious persecution. So he was involved in quite a few debates, public debates, in places like Tortosa and San Mateo, after 1413 and 1414, to represent the Jewish community. Many of these disputations took place against Christian religious thinkers, and some of them took place against Jewish apostates who became friars or Dominicans, whatever they were. So as part of this milieu, appreciating the significance of this now, we understand why Rabbi Yosef Albo wrote this this work that you have in front of you called Sefer HaIkarim. He's living in Castile now, which is right near Aragon. So he writes the Sefer HaIkarim because he's going to show you, he says, wait, let me show you. These are the things that we believe. These are things that are important for our faith. It's written more for us than it is for them on the outside, but it's so that we should understand what it is that really are our beliefs. What are we debating? What are we fighting for? So whereas the Rambam very notably has 13 principles of faith, 13 Ikari Amunah, so the Sefer HaIkarim actually boils it down to three. Just three things. And he says, look, you have to organize it in the following way. You have three Ikarim, three mega principles. Then under those, you have Shorashim, the roots, meaning derivatives, things that come from there. And then under that, you have Anafim. And it's important to distinguish between Shorashim and Ikarim on one side versus Anafim on the other side. Because there's a difference between being a heretic and a moron. That's an important distinction. If you deny one of the first two categories, you are a heretic. If you deny one of the anafim, you're not a heretic. You're an idiot, but you're not a heretic, which are important distinctions. So if you look on the last page of this salmon-colored packet, in the 26th chapter, he says, look, these are the three ikarim. These are the three main things that we all have to know. Card-carrying members, this is what you need to know. Number one, ki mispar, I put each of these in the underline. Ki mispar ha'ikarim ladasa elokim heim shlosha shehem. Number one, metzias Hashem. That there is a ribon shalom. That God exists. Number two, v'torah min hashamayim. Torah comes from heaven. And three, schar va'onesh. Now, what does that mean? Punishment and reward. What do those things that mean? So, we have to unpack them. He says, here they go. Let's number one. First underline, set of underlines. What is Mitzias Hashem, the existence of God? Ha'achdus, the unity of God, meaning that God is one integrated being, whatever that means. It's not composite parts, number one. Number two, Vasila Kaneshamos. God doesn't have a corporeal self. There is no hand of God. That's just a figure of speech. Number two, V'she'en lo yizbarach yachas im hazman. God is above time. And then where I put the tiny little number four, v'hu mesulak menach chesronos. There's nothing lacking. Omnipotent. What about Torah min hashamayim, the Torah is from God? That is the tiny number one, nevuah, prophecy. And number two, shlichus hashaliach, the emissary, meaning Moshe gave us the Torah. He got it from Hashem and he gave it to us, and that's what guides our life. And then number three, schar va'onesh, reward and punishment. What's that? That is yediyas Hashem, that God knows what's happening. Hashgacha, divine providence, schar va'onesh, reward and punishment, whether it's in this world or in the next world, whether it's spiritual or physical. So that'll include the Olam Haba, Tchias HaMesim, Mashiach, all this kind. So what actually you can do, according to this, is you can take the Rambam's 13 principles and actually recategorize them under the, so to speak, kind of, under the three main categories of Rav Yosef Albo. So today we focused already just on halacha, in the tshuva of the Trumas Hadeshin, a little bit in the halacha of the, although it wasn't a halachic insight, the tour, and now a little bit of something philosophy. Now let's move to the pink packets. Yes?
A basic question. If this was all done long before the days of the establishment of the printing press.
Yes.
How do we have the teaching or the scholarship of these gentlemen handed down? Did they write it and give it to one student?
Yes.
How was it all handed down from all these people?
Yes, there was a very... There was a very meticulous, especially, forget just about these, especially about the Torah scrolls themselves. There was a very meticulous tradition of scholars who their whole work in life was to transmit the written Torah from one generation to the next. There's a great article on this by Dr. Lyman, who we've mentioned before. On the one hand, if somebody tells you that our Sefer Torah is exactly letter for letter the same Sefer Torah that Moshe got and wrote and delivered at Arvos Moav, it's not true. It's not the accurate. There is already a Medrash that says that in the Azara, you know, in the Beis Hamikdash, in the inner sanctum is known as the Azara, and then inside that is the Heichal, they used to keep a Sefer Torah to be the authentic Sefer Torah. And they had a debate whether in the end of the Torah, the word in the last Aliyah, it starts Ma'ona Elokei Kedem. Is it spelled Ma'on or Ma'ona? So you're talking already a long, long time ago. So we have about 15. So Dr. Lyman has an article about the handful of letters, the Vavs, that are different. So the Medrash says, we paskin, it's Ma'ona, not Ma'on. You follow two of the three Sefer Torahs in the Azara. But the amazing thing is, you have to put it in context, which is, how many letters are there in the Torah? Upwards of 300,000 letters. How many generations has this been passed along? Hundreds. And yet, the whole discrepancy is sach hakol, one hey and an aleph, and about 15 vavs, which don't even impact. So what you have is, you had these people. Now today, we could do a whole shiur on this, which we don't have time for right now. But in the old editions of the Mikros Gedolos, they used to have in the margins... this is before my time. In the old margins, they used to have little notes, Masoretic notes. And they would have Masoretic notes because they would have, in these Tanakhs that were handwritten from generation to generation, the most famous family of this, the Rambam notes, is a family by the name of Ben Asher. People know about them, I think, because of the books on the Aleppo Codex. The Ben Asher family is the most famous family of Sofrim. Why they called so for the Gemara's case? Because they count the letters. So how do you know how anything is spelled? So they had little Masoretic notes where it would say, let's say, I don't know, some word in the Chumash that would say an unusual word. Let's say, Vayismamea. Vayismama. So there would be a Masoretic note. How many times this word appears in Tanakh? How many times it's spelled the same? And this way, every book that you had in your hand would have a Masoretic note in it. And if your Tanakh didn't match up according to the Masoretic note, you knew it was wrong. That's how they kept the spelling accurate over these thousands and thousands of years. It's unbelievable. So the same, this same tradition passed along from Rebbe to Talmud when it came to the Tanakh. Now, parallel to that, they had scribes who were writing down Pirushim, written texts that people had, and that's why it was so devastating, let's say, after the disputations in Paris in 1242, when they burned 24 cartloads of Sfarim. So what do you mean, 24 cartloads of Sfarim? So you can imagine, think about the man hours that it took to write those cartloads. You're talking hundreds of thousands of people's hours. Rashi, how did you have Rashi? Rashi wrote little booklets. So Tosfos, when he calls Rashi, he calls him the Kuntris, the notebooks. Rashi wrote little notebooks. His students wrote them down, then they copied them and copied them and copied them, and that's how we have it. Until, you know, the 15th century, what was it, 1455 was the first published Gutenberg Bible. So until that point, people literally were writing them hand, which actually brings us to our next figure, which is first one on the pink pages, Rav Avram Sava. We don't know exactly where he was born, but probably in this little town called Zamora. You see where number one is on the map? Zamora, it's near the border of Portugal. This is going to be very important, Mrs. Poland. The question that you just asked is going to be incredibly powerful in this next figure. So I want to move now to a Pirush on Chumash. His name is Rav Avram Sava. In 1492, he had already written a halachic work called Tzror HaKesef. He is living in Zamora in Castile, so this area. Let's see where It's about like over here, Castile. No, here. Like around here. It's on. You see it on your map. He gets kicked out of Spain in 1492. He had a massive library, many students. He was very prominent in his community. He and his wife and his two sons have to travel, and they end up near Lisbon. So now they're in Portugal. First, he ends up in a place called Gemars. Then after that, in 1497, with the destruction, the expulsion of Jews from Portugal, he's forced to leave. But not just that. First, he had to go. He was driven to Lisbon, near Lisbon. It was kind of, called, I guess you would call it like a concentration camp, where these Jews were held, about 40,000 Jews. I'll tell you exactly. I'm trying to remember what it was called. No, not 40,000. 10,000 Jews. In Lisbon, in this particular area of Lisbon. And for 4 days, they were kept in this camp. And the local church officials, they forced people to convert to Christianity. And at the end of 4 days, the vast, vast majority, including his family members, Rav Avram Saba, had been forced to convert to Christianity. Only about 40 people absolutely insisted, despite terrible torture, on not converting. Then he gets sent to some other camp, and then he gets shipped out on a boat after about 6 months in a prison. But what happens? While he is there in this concentration camp near in this area where they're being held, near Lisbon, he has his manuscripts. He has his Chidushim on Halacha, and he wrote a Pirush on Chumash called Tzror Hamor. And what does he do? He gets a... There's a decree by the king of... What was his name? Manuel, I think. I forget his name. There was a decree by Manuel, exactly, that any Jew who was found to have a book, a pair of tefillin, or any holy scriptures is going to be put to death. So he had to take his entire life's work, exactly what you're talking about, he went to a particular place and he buried it in the hope that one day he would come back and find it, which he never did. He then gets sent on this crazy journey by boat after this whole horrific ordeal where he loses his family, they become a shumadim, he leaves his sons, he travels to North Africa, and then he ends up in Al-Qatsar for about 4 months. Long story. Finally, he ends up in 1499 in Fez. And on his journey, what does he do? He rewrites from memory his commentary on the Chumash. It's amazing. But that was it, because he realized, and by the way, we didn't discuss, you know, similar, you have a similar, I wanted to bring him, because last year we spoke about Abarbanel, for those who were not here, I apologize, but this was all he had, this was his whole life. Abarbanel similarly wrote much of his Pirush, although he didn't have to destroy it, wrote much of his Pirush on Chumash on the road, when he was traveling from place to place, having been expelled from Spain. So what that makes this comment that you're going to see on this page, this is the Tzor Hamor, you have it in front of you. This is an older edition, although now I saw recently, there was a newer edition, the Tzor Hamor, that was published. Who would have thought? Meaning, this is a man who died 700 years ago, whenever it was. He never thought that his words would still be studied, and yet we're still studying it today, right here together. So what's interesting is, this is a comment in the end of Parshas Chukas, where the Tzor Hamor, where Rav Avram Saba is talking about a prophecy, a song, the words are Esvoev Besufa Va'alderech HaRemez, and they underline, Nira Shigi Bekan HaGeula Ho'asida. It's talking about the future redemption. Because the Pasuk says, Al-Ken Yamar B'Sefer Milchamos Hashem Esvoev Besufa. So what is that? It's referring to the war at the end of days. Who is the last war? It's the Melchama against Amalek. Well, Amalek is the son, the grandson, the descendant of Esav. And Esav is associated, in the words of Chazal, with Rome. So there's like a continuum. There's a continuum with the association of Esav and Edom and Amalek and Rome, which is closely associated with
Germany.
Okay, later with Germany, but with the Catholic Church after the 4th century. So the Romans and the Christians are hand in hand. So what do we find interesting in this? He refers to the continuum, and on the last line, Kikach darkam lishol mi Yisrael misim va'arnonos. You know what these people do? They always ask us for extra taxes. And next page. Ula olam heim sholim hav hav va'aluka hu remez liyetzahara hu edom. So he's describing the continuum of this battle, this epic struggle with Edom and Esav in the context of the Christians who are persecuting them. And he sees himself and the historical period that he's living in as part of this long prophetic description of what's going to happen throughout the whole continuum of history. It's really quite fascinating. So the Rav Saba is here just at the end of this Tekufa of the Rishonim, and now we're going to start to move over to transition to the Acharonim, now in the 16th century. We're going to move to Egypt to Rav David ibn Zimra. Rav David ibn Zimra, born in 1479, died in 1573. What does that mean if he was born in Spain in 1479? What's that? That's right. At 13 years old, he's kicked out. So he travels to Tzfat, which is a very common thing, which we'll talk about in a little bit. He travels to Tzfat and then moves to Yerushalayim. Before, in 1513, he settles in Cairo. I'm sorry, first in Alexandria, and then in Cairo, where he joins the Beis Din, and he becomes the leading rabbinic authority in Egypt. And not just in Egypt, in many, is very, very well known. He's extremely famous. In 1553, he returns to Israel, he settles in Yerushalayim, and then he goes back to Tzfat. But ultimately, his fame is about his hugely important role in public life in Egypt, where he's very involved in public policy matters, even in terms of changing how documents are written, to a lot of different important things. He also writes a commentary on the Rambam in places where there is an absence of the Magid Mishnah, which is an earlier comment on the Rambam. He fills in with his own commentary on the Rambam, and he wrote many different she'ilot and tshuvot, many different shailas and tshuvas. So here, I was very torn. There are two of the most famous tshuvas of the Radvaz. I chose one, but I'll tell you the one that I did not choose for us to learn inside, which would have also been extremely interesting. And that is the following. Here's the background. Keeping in mind that in those days, we mentioned this once before, piracy had nothing to do with the internet. Piracy in those days was actually, there were pirates who were roaming the seas, capturing people, and that was a way of making a living. I mean, it was a way to make a living. And there were a lot of issues that were coming up in Jewish communities that had to do with ransom and things like that. So here is the shaila that we're not going to look at today. He was asked, what happens if somebody is captured by a pirate, whatever, some gangster, and the gangster says, look, obviously you can't observe any religious practices here, but here's what I'll do. I'll let you go out for one day. You want one day leave? You could take one day. When would you take it?
Yom Kippur.
Okay. That's one option. Radvaz says no. He says, you know when you take it? Today.
Which you might not be able to take it.
Take it today. Put on tefillin today. Daven shacharis today. So that's one old thing. But here, this tshuva that we're going to learn together today is a very important tshuva. Halacha l'maisa, it's very important because it comes up occasionally. Unfortunately, nobody should need this. But once in a while, there is a question about someone donating a kidney or some other organ. And Rav Ovadia Zichrono Livracha has in the Echav Hadas, he has a tshuva about organ donation. And much of that tshuva is predicated on this important tshuva. What's the tshuva? It's mezazeah. It's hair-raising, what you're going to read right now. She'ela. Sha'alta mimen, you asked me a question. Odia chadaiti. I should tell you what I think. Al ma she'ra'isa kosov. On that which you saw written. What is the issue? Omar ha'shilton. Forget the pirate, the local governor, said to the Jewish person, Hanach li lekatzeitz eiver echad she'in chames. Let me cut off one of your limbs, that you will not die. O omis es Yisrael chavirecha, or I'll kill someone, your Jewish friend. Are you obligated? He says, I'll cut off your hand, God forbid. I'll cut off your hand, and by doing that, you will save your neighbor's life. Are you obligated to give up your hand, or your ear, or some other non-lethal, you know, they're going to guarantee, as much as they can guarantee, that you won't die, but if you don't do that, that next person will die. Just imagine, just for a second. Oh, so that's what I was just going to say. Imagine what you're dealing with. Frege Kasha, why did he want to do this? This is the, you know, we are living in a time and a place that it's so different than what most people experienced. You know, having studied for different years for Tisha B'Av, you read the lives of Jews from North Africa to Eastern Europe, you know, and everything in between. The type of experiences they had, they're incomprehensible to us. I found it amazing, and I actually said it to the police officer who came here a couple of weeks ago. We had a thing, they gave a presentation to the Skokie Police and Fire Department. I said to the cop afterwards, turns out he was Jewish, I said to him, it's Mamish Mizazea. I said, my grandparents, when they heard the police coming where they came from, they ran the other way. The police didn't protect us, they killed us. So in these countries, it's like we can't even wrap our head around this. That was, you know, one guy woke up, a government official woke up one day and decided, you know what, the Jews in the neighborhood, we need money, so we'll tax them. This is commonplace. Or we want to get extortion, you know, we want something from someone, so okay, we'll cut off your ear, otherwise we'll do this or that. It's unbelievable. So what's the psak? Tshuva. So he writes on the bottom, says the Hilga Radvaz, Zu Midas Chasidus. It is an act of piety. It's an incredibly pious thing to do. Aval ladin, but to say it's mandated according to the law, yesh tshuva, there is an answer. And then he goes on to explain his argument on the next column. You can take a look at it. It's only one paragraph. And this becomes the basis, says Rav Avadya, for the mainstream accepted approach when it comes to organ donation. I mean, living organ donation. Whereas, you know, a person, they need both their kidneys. You know, everybody should be well. At the same time, it's possible, as I'm told, it's possible to live with one kidney. And it's possible, apparently, to live a proper life. Right? A person can live a healthy, normal life. And then another person, Rahman al-Islam, has no kidneys. So they really need it. Potential pikuach nefesh. So can the Beis Din drag the donor to the hospital and say, are we going in? No, so the Radvan says you can't do that. But is it a midas chasidus? It is. It's an act of tremendous piety. And some people, there's no room. We know people who have done such unbelievably. These are unbelievably heroic things. So what we're seeing here is that there are strata in the halacha. There is what's required by the din, what's legally absolutely expected by Hashem Yisbarach, and then there are opportunities. It's a similar kind of thing. Sometimes you see, I remember a couple of years ago, it was a terrible, terrible thing that there was a child who was drowning in Lake Michigan. So somebody else went in to save the child, and they themselves drowned. This is a discussion in the Pesachei Tshuva, in the end of Choshen Mishpat, about whether or not a person is allowed to endanger their own life. So some say it's us, or some say it's a chiyuv, and the generally accepted opinion, I think, is like this Radvaz, that says that it's not mechuyuv, you're not obligated, but it's an amazing midas chasidus. So this Radvaz is very important in terms of navigating both the question, the practical question of organ donation, but also understanding that there can be different layers in a person's religious life. You know, there's the baseline, this is what I have to do, and then there is the, what we could call lefnim mishuras hadin, above, beyond the letter of the law. So let's move on to page 13, one of the great controversies. If you were living in the 16th century, this was big. Born in 1474, Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, born near Toledo. Where does he go in 1492? So he goes first to Fez at the age of 18. He is appointed as the chief rabbi of Fez, and then later he travels to Egypt, and then Syria, and finally he settles in Tzfat. And in 1538, he comes up with the following idea. He says, you know what we should be doing? We should renew smicha. Smicha. What is smicha? Anybody know what smicha is? What's smicha? What's that? Ordination. What does that mean? Exactly. From teacher to student, from Moshe to Yehoshua. Now, I have a letter. It's framed on my wall in my office. And it says that I can paskin shilas. It's a piece of paper, let's be honest. But it's not real smicha. It's not authentic smicha, which would have a huge number of ramifications. A lot of them having to do with what kind of laws you can adjudicate. Can you do what's called dine knasos, punishments that are beyond the actual monetary amount that's being discussed? Let's say penalties, things like that. Or putting people to death. Lots of other things that require smuchin. So the first mission, the beginning of Sanhedrin, discusses which things require smicha. Gzelas v'chavolos, etc., as opposed to hodos v'alvos. Fine. So Maribe Rav says, look at this Rambam. Take a look. But you have, it's not from the Maribe Rav, this is from the Rambam. There, after this was a whole kudus of smicha. Look at this Rambam. You'll see what is so fascinating. He says, Hare, the Rambam writes, this is in Hilchos Sanhedrin in the fourth chapter in Halacha Yud Aleph. Hare shelo haya be'eretz Yisrael. Let's say there wasn't in Israel, Ela samach echad. There was only one man who had smicha. So for example, the Gemara tells us in the beginning of Sanhedrin that one of the last musmachim, I think it was Rav Yehuda ben Beseira, so he wanted to continue to give smicha, but you only can give smicha in Israel. So the Romans prohibited it. He gathered a few students, he gave them smicha, and he told them, run away before the Romans came and murdered him, Al-Kiddush Hashem, for giving smicha. So let's say the Rambam says, let's say I have only one man who can give smicha, no problem. Get two other people, you can form a beis din, a rabbinic court. Elas moshev shnayim betzidu v'somich shivim ke'echad, o zeach hazeh. You can give smicha to as many people as you want. Rav, so some of you are familiar with Rav, the great rabbinic figure from the Amoraim. Rav had smicha. That's why it was called Rav. But his counterpart, Shmuel, never had smicha. And then they both moved to Babel, so Shmuel couldn't get smicha anymore because they have to be in Israel to get smicha from somebody who previously had smicha. So let's say in Israel you had Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi. Rabbi says, that means rabbi, that means they had smicha. But in Bavel, you had Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. Rav means they did not have smicha. That's how you know who did and who didn't. If it's Rebbe, they had smicha, they came from Israel. They could keep their smicha when they go to Bavel, but they can only get smicha in Israel. So the Rambam says you can give people, as many people, you smicha as you want. Fourth line of the Rambam, Nirin liadvarim, it seems to me, Shem iskimu kol hachachamim shebe'eretz Yisrael, if all of the rabbis in the land of Israel... Okay, this is a parenthetical note, but it's not for now, but it's to keep in mind. The only Jewish community that exists is in Israel. We don't count. Anybody outside of Israel does not count for this purpose, like many other things. Only the Jews of Israel count for national questions. So smicha is a national question, it's a national institution. The calendar, you can't affect the calendar if you're in Chutz La'aretz. A lot of different things. We're very nice people. I mean, look around the room, such a nice group. We do a lot of good things, a lot of tzedakah, masim tovim, mitzvahs, all those things are good, but we're not really a Jewish community. You could tell that to the Federation, they won't be so happy, but it's true. The only community, so to speak, is in Israel. And that's why the Rambam says, the only rabbis that count are the rabbis in Israel. You can have a lot of rabbis who are not in Israel, they don't count to this decision of how to restart to create smicha. So the Rambam says, it seems to me, yeah.
Why it seems, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like a lot of Halachas, Rav and Shmuel, you hold by Rav, or is there a difference in them? In Gemara,
that's a great question. So the truth is, the Gemara has a principle, Hilchasa k'Rav b'Isuri g'Shmuel b'Dinei. Usually when it comes to Isur v'Heter questions, we follow Rav, but when it comes to monetary questions, we follow Shmuel. I'm not sure if that's a function of... I don't know, I'm not sure. Well... You certainly have some Amoraim who have greater expertise in areas of Choshen Mishpat versus Yoredeh, things like that. But that's a good question. Rav had, let's say the Gemara says, at the beginning of Sanhedrin, Rav worked on a farm for several months to learn about the laws of Bechor, animals, what makes them healthy, unhealthy. So different people had different expertise. I'm not sure if it's a function of the smicha per se, but Rav definitely had a unique smicha component, like when it comes to Bechor, the farm story.
Where did Rav live then?
So Rav started in Israel, and then...
Whatever.
One second. I think he lives in Sura, and Shmuel lives in Pumbedisa. What's that?
Babylonia.
Yeah, Babylonia. Yeah.
So then they lose it? When they
no, they keep it, but they can't give it to anyone else. That's why Smicha expired. Because what happened was with the increasing persecution, so the Talmud Yerushalmi gets written, edited, and finished, because there's not a lot of scholarship going on thanks to the Roman insistence on a clampdown against scholarship. So everything moves to Bavel, and then the Smicha dies out. The Yerushalmi is edited, I don't know, the middle of the 3rd century, but by that time, middle of the 3rd century, by that time, most of the Talmidei Chachamim, they're moving to Bavel. We can live like a mensch. Someone had a hand. Yeah.
So, why don't we go by the Talmud Yerushalmi versus the Talmud Bavel?
So it's a great question. Great. So it's a great question. So part of it has to do with the fact that because of the nature of the persecution, so you don't have the full development of the scholarship in the Talmud Yerushalmi. It's written, it's a lot more terse. It doesn't have the full development because of that circumstance. So when you learn Yerushalmi, it's definitely incorporated. You learn the Rambam. The Rambam relies heavily on the Yerushalmi. Let's say when I was growing up as a yeshiva boy, so you start with the Bavli, but then when you grow a little older and you start learning more, let's say Rav Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, so many times in his shiurim, he would say, of course, when you learn the sugya, you have to look at the parallel sugyas in the Yerushalmi, which play a big role in the Rambam and many later poskim. All the time, the Yerushalmi plays a big role. But it doesn't. Usually, when there's a machlokas, when there's a debate between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, we follow the Bavli. But if there's no opinion, there's no authoritative psak in the Bavli, we'll follow the Yerushalmi. It's just a different, that's a whole other Torah. Okay, so the Rambam says, you get all the sages of Israel together in Israel, and Hare Elu Somchim, they can create smicha. And Dan Dine Knossos, etc. Aye, so why the Imkain, Loma Hoyu Achachamim Itstaran al Smicha? Why were the rabbis so sad of the loss of Smicha? Lafishi Yisrael Mefuzarin, because Jews are scattered all over, V'yefsha Shiaskimu Kulam, they can't get together. Then the Rambam says, if there was a Samach Mipi Samach, then you don't need everybody's opinion, he can just do it on his own. Rambam concludes, last three words of the halacha, V'hadavar Tzorech Hechrea. The matter requires a decision. So those three words are loaded. Says the Ma'ari Beirav, look at the basic comment of the Rambam, and it sounds like for the Rambam that if we all get together, we can create smicha. Why would the Ma'ari Beirav want to create smicha? Well, there may be two big movements that are afoot here. One is the ascent of Kabbalah, the influence of Kabbalah, especially in Tzfat, in the 16th century. That's one. The next one, this is amazing. Okay, you ready? Hold on to your seats. The Gemara says in Maseches Makos the following. Kol chai v'krisos, anybody who, God forbid, is liable for a punishment of kares, and the Gemara has a discussion about Mises Bezdin, if they get malchus, what's malchus? A form of lashes, right? 39 lashes from a Bezdin of smuchim. So then they remove themselves, they are pater from kares. So look in the Maharal Bach, he says something amazing. When are we living? We're living in the generation of Maranos. Because even though, yes, we're talking about the rabbis who ran away, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews who became, quote-unquote, new Christians or living as crypto-Jews. And they did all kinds of things. They make their way to Israel, they migrate different places, and they come to the rabbis and they say, look at us. Our souls are stained. Look at the things that we did. We're Chayiv Mises Bezdin, we're Chayiv Kares. You know what we're going to do? We would like to get Malkus. We're lining up for a beating. Who's first? Because we know that if we get Malkus, that will help expiate the old sins that we have, that we're carrying with us from our lives as conversos, as crypto Jews, whatever we were doing over there. And the rabbi says, sorry, I'm happy to beat you, but it won't count because you need a bezin of smuchin. So the people say, fine, let's get some smuchin and let's start the beating. Amazing. So with all of this going on, there becomes a huge interest in the Chiddush HaSmicha. So the Maribe Rav gets some major heavy hitters like the Mabit Rav Moshe of Trani and someone else by the name of Rav Yosef Karo, who think, yeah, this is a great idea. They convene a bezin, they say, great, we're all going to start creating smicha. They send a letter to Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, to a man by the name of Maharal Bach, Rav Levi Ibn Chabib, who says, oh no, I do not agree with you. Look at the last line of the Rambam. The Rambam says, V'adavar tzarech echreya. So it becomes a huge controversy, the smicha controversy of the 16th century. Now, despite the objections of Maharal Bach, they did in Sfat give smicha to Mahari Bei Rav, Rav Yaakov Bei Rav, who in turn gave it to Rav Yosef Karo. But then it peters out. Why? Because the Maharal Bach, Rav Levi Ibn Chabib in Yerushalayim, marshals the support of the great rabbinic figure of the century and of the era, that neighborhood, who was living in Cairo. Who was that? Rav David Ben Zimra, who we just mentioned, Radvaz. Rav David Ben Zimra came out on the side of the anti-smicha, and that's why the smicha never took hold. But this became... No, it was really, it's a lot of, I mean, I didn't go through the whole countries. It's like dozens of pages of scholarship of Torah learning. But this became the major controversy of the time about the Chiddush HaSmicha. Okay? Yes, keep going.
You said all you have, two differences, is a piece of paper.
Yeah, not so important.
On the wall, not so important.
Right.
So what does it mean now to have smicha?
It means real what I said. So there's a tshuva of the Rifosh. Rav Yitzchak ben Sheshes of, I think it was Algiers, I don't know, 600 years ago. So he has an important smicha, a tshuva about this. And it's quoted by the Rama and others in Hilchos Talmud Torah. So it's a big question. What is the significance of smicha? What does it mean? So part of the purpose of smicha is for a communal standards. So that when a guy, you know, goes out for a prabha, so people should know, can they rely on him? Can't they rely on him? What is his training? So that's a, my smicha, it says what I learned. It says I learned Basa B'chalav, and I learned Hilchos this, and Hilchos that. So that's a much larger question. But if you look in this Rivash, which I can send you to, it's quoted in the Ramah, there they discuss exactly, well, what is the meaning of real smicha, and what is the meaning of smicha b'zman hazeh? What's that tradition that's been going back, obviously, many hundreds of years? But that's the most important, the tshuva of the Rivash is the most important. It's a long tshuva, but it's kedai. Okay, let's go to Italy. A couple of years ago, I don't remember when, we discussed this Hakdama of the Sforno, Rav Ovadia Sforno, so we're not going to go through it too long. But he's living, he's born in Cesena, in Italy. He studies philosophy, mathematics, philology, and medicine in Rome. And then he settles in Bologna. So if you go back to your map, you see the little number, see Bologna here on the number 4. It's like kind of north. And he is renowned as a significant rabbinic figure of that period, Rav Ovadia Sforno. He's even referenced by Rav Meir Katzenellenbogen, the author of the Tshuvas Maharami Padua, as a great rabbinic figure. He has an important rapport, which is significant if you contrast it especially with, let's say, Polish Jews, in that the Sforno and many other Italian rabbinic figures had a very happy-go-lucky relationship with their Christian neighbors. You know, there's actually a high level of interaction, positive interaction, between Italian Jews and the Christian chevra in the neighborhood.
Even though the Catholic Church was
Yes, quite interestingly. Even though at this time, so we are 1470, technically speaking, in other places, the Inquisition is still going. Right, the Inquisition still goes on for several centuries. Right? The Inquisition starts before it takes on different meaning in different places. But the Inquisition is going on for several centuries. But in Italy, you know, one of the big things that's happening now in the 15th century is the creation of the printing press. So one of the most common places for printed books, you know, in the 15th and then certainly into the 16th century is in Italy, Livorno. In northern Italy, it's one of the big places where printing was taking place, and many Jewish books were printed in these places. Now, you're right, of course, there was a book burning in Rome in, I'm trying to remember, 1530-something or 1520-something. It wasn't like all roses, but there was a high level of acculturation by Italian Jews. So at the same time, there's a great level of scholarship. So he establishes a base medrash there. And at the, you know, on the same time, no, it's 1553. 1553 is when they burned the Talmud in Rome. And there was also, in 1516, there was also the establishment of the first ghetto. So on some level, I guess we should say it's more nuanced. On some level, there was an interaction between the Jews and the non-Jews. On the other hand, there was some persecution. Yeah.
There are some scholars who say that the introduction of the ghetto,
yes,
which we like to think isolated the Jews, was really the changing point, because the Goyim were allowed in and the Jews were allowed out. Uh-huh. And so instead of isolating us, it was the first time that Jewish people in Venice, in the ghetto, got to meet the professors from the University of Padua and all those places.
Interesting.
And there was a great cross-section of Jews with the
non-Jews.
And it was the opposite of what most of us were taught in school, that you get in the ghetto and you're isolated. Lahavdil, this was to introduce Goyim who wanted to come in and meet with us.
Interesting. Fascinating.
I think it's also to remember that you can't really talk about Italy, because you can't talk about Italy until 1860 or 1870, because you had Rome or or Venice. And the other thing about the ghetto is, in effect, it gave Jews legitimacy, because it said, you have a place. You're, you know, more or less not going to be kicked out at the whim of the particular...
Right, especially, like, I guess, contrasting it to a place like France, where they couldn't own land and things like that. Okay, so this, I'm going to say it outside, because some of us have seen this inside. I don't want to belabor the point inside. But this Hakdama of the Sforno is very important in terms of Parshanut, but also in terms of Jewish philosophy. I guess you could ask like this. Are we racist?
Yeah.
Well, Sforno says no. He says, I'll tell you why. We believe, says the Sforno, that the Ribono Shalom, God gave the world to all of humanity and gave us a job to bring godliness into the world. That's our job. Now, to do that, we need to live up to godly expectations. So God created the first family, and what happens? One brother kills the next brother. Now, that's not godly expectations. I have a brother who's 16 months younger than me. I can understand the story. I get it. But that's not like the way it's supposed to be played out. Then it says, okay, let's start this. Let's try to do this again. Get out of the garden. We'll start again. What happens after a couple of centuries? People are stealing. They're robbing. There's total corruption. Balsham says, okay, I'm going to take out the hose. And I'm going to hose it all away. And let's try this one more time. Let's give you a third shot. This is what we call the three strikes and you're out rule. One more time. Let's try to do this again. And then immediately after the Dor HaMabul comes what we call the Dor HaFlaga, the door of the dispersion, which if you look in the Netziv, which we'll talk about a little bit next week, awesome shot from the Netziv. Netziv says that the Dor HaFlaga was the first tyrannical regime. It was the first totalitarian society. So Hashem says, look, after all this, this is just a disaster. What comes immediately after the generation of the dispersion in the Chumash? What's that?
Avraham.
Yes. Because the Sforno says, this is three strikes and you're out. You know, God says, I tried it with everybody. I tried that the whole world should live in a godly spirit. It just didn't work. So you know what? Let's come up with this idea. Let's choose one guy and one family, one clan, and they'll live in this godly context, and they'll teach everybody else. They'll model for everybody else what the ideal world is supposed to be. That, says the Sforno, is the story of Avraham Avinu. And therefore, we're not racist. We don't think we're better than anybody else. We don't think that it's us and nobody. It's that, according to the Sforno, we're there to try to be the model for everybody else to follow us, to create that extra level of expectation. It parallels another idea. If you look, Rabbi David Foreman has this idea about B'ni B'chori Yisrael. Baruch Hashem, we have 5 children at home, so our oldest is 11. So imagine if he's playing in the back with the other kids, and one of the other kids, God forbid, hurts themselves. So we come outside, and we see our oldest, 11 years old, we see he's like totally apathetic, totally does not care. You're like, what's your problem? Why don't you come tell us? He's like, I don't care. I'm the firstborn. He's not. I mean, like, I'm a Bechor. He's a Pashut. Who cares? So at least in our house, that would not be acceptable. Just because you're the firstborn doesn't mean that the other children don't matter. Now, the firstborn has a special role because as the oldest, they model for the younger children. The parents can't ever be role models because the parents are parents. The parents are not children. But the first child kind of models, shows the other kids, the younger kids, what the parents expect if he's, you know, he or she is acting in that way that the parents set out. So the older children have, you know, they get the driver's license first and they get privileges first. They have certain things that come first. So that is the role of the Jewish people. We have certain extra responsibilities. Yeah, if you're the oldest child, you can't be picking your nose at the Shabbos table because the younger kids are looking at you. Besides the fact that's a bad idea in general. But right. I'm just saying everybody. So the idea that we are not better than anybody else, but we're in a position that Hashem expects us to model for others so that ultimately the stock in Olam HaShakai, at the end of the day, everybody will come around, that's very significant.
Who do you know are gamblers? I mean, dope peddlers, murderers, killers?
Thankfully, not too many. So, unfortunately, though, as we well know, somebody asked me this question in a different formulation. So there is an old saying, which is very important, and that is, you can't judge Judaism by the Jews. People are people. People have bechira chavshis, and we have choices. Just read yesterday's parsha. We had a choice, and we blew it. And we consistently have choices, and we have to consistently make good choices, but we don't always make good choices. You know, it's not that necessarily people are bad people, it's just they make sometimes really bad choices. Yeah?
Do you think it's possible that there could be a parallel discussion with another religion that's sitting here in another room somewhere else, having the same discussion that they feel that they are God's chosen people? You know,
probably, I suspect, right? There is a whole other religion that says we were chosen and then we were swapped out, I believe. I think that's Christianity.
Islam says both of those religions have been swapped out.
Right, for them. For the Prophet Muhammad.
Islam says that we were all born Muslims, but it's our parents who corrupted us.
So I guess 2 points. Number one is, I never studied comparative religion, so I can't really speak intelligently about that question.
You know, it's more like a theoretical, you know, what makes us logic, you know, right?
So this was going to be the second point, which is, why is it that we're so convinced that we're right? So part of the answer to that question is exactly this, and that's the part of the purpose of why we're doing this, which is that the more you appreciate, imagine you're hanging on to a cord. Off the edge of a building, you're holding on to a cord. So if that cord is very thin and very flimsy, it doesn't give you a lot of confidence. But if you are holding on to a cord that's made of thousands, like one of those sailors, those thick ship ropes, and you ever go to a maritime museum, you ever go to those things where they have like in Connecticut, Mr. Connecticut, you go, they have like they show you like a thick, like really braided, hundreds and hundreds. They have the special way that the sailors put these ropes together. They can haul ships with them up to the barges. They tie them up. So you feel a lot more confident. So it's very important for our children, but for ourselves, to be able to understand the chain of Mesorah, to understand the chain of tradition, so that you realize that we have a very thick rope. And when you do that, you know, some people, their line of work and their interest is comparing religions to other religions. You know, it's good, it takes time, but I think the first thing is for us to realize the significance, the weight. I use that mashal because the Gemara has this idea of Ashli Ravarvi, great chains, thick vines. So if we're holding on to a tradition that we see the scholarship and the integrity of the text, we talked before about the Mesorah, the transmission that was done so carefully of the Torah that we have, so then it gives you a lot more confidence to say, yeah, we have something that we are passionate about and that we're going to share it with the next generation because we know it to be true. Now, you know, is it possible that other people have different beliefs? I'm sure they do. But it's important for us, not just because we're interested in history, to know history, but sha'alavicha v'yageitcha, you have to know how it is that a halacha came from Moshe at Sinai to your Shabbos table. You have to know that to be able to fully embrace it. So let's conclude today with the last piece here. Rav Avram Abela Gombiner, the Magen Avram. So the Magen Avram is right here. So here's Rav Moshe Isserles. Here's Beis Yosef. So he's living in Spain. So this period, Rav Moshe Isserles is living at the end of the 16th century. Magen Avram is living in the middle of the 17th century. Born in 1637. Magen Avram, a very important commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, an Orach Chaim, which is what you're looking at here. Magen Avram was affected, like many of the other commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, by a very cataclysmic, a very, very terrifying event that took place over the course of 1648, known as Khmelnytsky Massacres. So Khmelnytsky Massacres, that was the Ukrainian Cossack uprising against Polish overlords, noblemen. But the Jews got caught in the middle, and so the wrath, the awful, indescribably torturous events of the Khmelnytsky massacres totally devastated the Jewish communities in Eastern Europe. So this is an important map. This is the map of the Vad Arba Aratzos, because over the course of centuries, now there were some, so this is Poland here, there were some, let's say if you look in Yaffa Eliach, she should have Rachmana, she's not doing so well. She should be well. So Yaffa Eliach has, in one of her books, it's called There Once Was a World, she 900 years, she documents the history of her shtetl. She grew up in a place called Eisenach. So there were Jews in Poland for a very, very long time. But predominantly, as the Jews were getting kicked out of Paris, France, this area in the 14th century, then they're moving into Germany in the 15th, so they continue to migrate east, and they settle in these areas in Poland, and Ukraine, Belarus, up into Lithuania, to the point where, by the middle of the 17th century, you have something called the Vad Arba Aratzos. You have an autonomous region that's governed by the Council of the Four Lands. This was basically a Jewish government that paid taxes to the non-Jewish government, but they took care of essential out of internal affairs. So you're talking all the way from Vilna, this is Poland, Brest-Litovsk, down here, this is Krakow, this is Posen. Posen is in Prussia. We'll talk about it next week with the Gaon Rabbi Kiva Eger. So you're talking about huge swath. This is Slutsk, later famous for a famous yeshiva there. Pinsk, so now you're into Ukraine. This is Volhynia. Down here is Russia. All of this area is under the control of the Vad Arba Aratzos in the 17th century. Come 1648, and the Khmelnytsky massacres are devastating, all the way reaching as far as Vilna, down into Poland, and the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, the Ashkenazi commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, are almost all affected. The Magen Avram, Rav Avram Abela Gombiner, both of his parents were murdered in the Khmelnytsky massacres. There's a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch called the Be'er HaGola, Rav Moshe Rivkus affected by it, the Taz was affected, the Shach, Rav Shabbosai Cohen, one of the most important, prestigious scholars, he himself had to run away, was nearly killed. He wrote something called Megillas Eifa, a little chronicle of what happened to him personally in the Khmelnytsky massacres. Like, it's unbelievably devastating throughout this whole area. So the Magen Avram, he lives in Lithuania, and then later went to Kalish, where he becomes the head of Yeshiva and a Bezdin. He wrote a commentary on the Yalkut Shimoni called the Zayas Ranan, very interesting, but most well known is for this commentary, Magen Avram, which is his commentary on Shulchan Aruch. So we'll just conclude with this one idea, which is going to be very important. The Shulchan Aruch here in Hilchos Netilas Yadayim distinguishes between, if you have a bucket, in halach here, it's in Simen Kuf Nun Tes in Orach Chaim. Im Haisa, in the underline, Im Haisa Barza, if you have a spigot, Benekev, with a hole, Vehisira, and you pull out the spigot, Vekibel Hamayim Al Yadav, and you caught the water, on your hand, Choshev Shaper Koach Gavra, Vitzarach Lahachzira Ulahasira B'chol Shvicha Ushvicha. So let's say, for example, you have one of those big igloo water containers. You know, on the sidelines of the games, you see they have those the igloo water containers. So how do you get water out of the igloo container? You push the button, and the water comes out. So the Magen Avram, the Shulchan Aruch says that for Hilchos Netilas Yadayim, we know the Gemara tells you have to have koach gavra. You have to have the human hand that has to pour the water on your hand for Netilas Yadayim. Well, what if you have a spigot? So when you press the button, the Shulchan Aruch says, the first gush that comes out, that's called koach gavra, because you're opening the hole. But once you open it, everything else that comes down for the next 5 minutes, that's not koach gavra. That doesn't count for netilas sidayim. So you have to push it once, and then let it go, and then push it again. Okay. But then, the Magen Avraham asks, but wait a minute, earlier the Shulchan Aruch said, if I have a bucket, and I tip the bucket over, and it spills, let's say it spills for about 10 minutes, all that's called koach gavra. I just stick my hands under it once, twice, three times, four times, done. What's the difference? So the Magen Avraham says something very important here in Chaf Aleph, and this is going to have a lot of nafkaminas for other areas of halacha. Va'af al gav, even though the besiftes, earlier in siftes, kosav de kiluach rishon levad choshev koach gavra, later on, the Magen Avraham writes, he says, wow, how could it be that if you spill the barrel, this is an halacha yud? Earlier it said when you only the first dub. So he says, hasam delo asam maisa beguf hamayim rak shehiser habarza hamonas milatzis. He says, what's the difference? He says, in siftes, where it talks about the igloo, where you push the button and the water comes out, what happens when you push the button? Why does the water come out? How? How does that? You're opening the valve, you're removing the little blocker that's keeping the water back, right? As opposed to, says the Magen Avraham, when I take a bucket and pour it, there I'm actually pouring the water. I'm not removing something that's an impediment. He says that's the difference. When you remove an impediment, that's not your action, that's just removal of an impediment. So only the initial effect, the first gush of water, is attributed to you. Whereas if you turn the bucket, this is the difference, perhaps, that's going to be important for what we call grama, causation. Because when I remove, so example, forget the bucket for a second, let's go back to a much bigger case. Let's say I have a dam, and I open the dam, and the gush of water comes out. Did I do that, or did I not do that? What would you say? Is it called my... Can I wash a tilas yadayim if I open up a dam and a huge gush of water comes down? What would you say? Yes or no? Yeah. What's that? I'm moving an impediment. So only the first gush is good for a tilas yadayim. But then when the water comes downstream, let's say the water gets 5 miles down, imagine like one of these giant dams in Utah, that's not good for a tilas yadayim because it's too far along. As opposed to if I took a huge bottle of water and poured it. Same thing would be for the laws of murder. Let's say, like in the old, the Rocky and Bullwinkle, Boris Badenoff, he takes somebody, ties them down right next to the dam, and then he's going to blow up the dam. So Boris Badenoff is only Chayav Misa if he blows up the dam and the person dies right away. Obviously, they don't, because Dudley Do-Right will be there, Baruch Hashem. But theoretically, if they blew up the dam and they got the person right away, that's the first thing. But if they blow up the dam and only 10 miles later someone's trapped at the bottom, then they get killed. Did I kill them? No. That's more like a grumma. So this Magen Avraham is huge for Hilchos Shabbos. How do you determine what's an action and what's a grumma? Because we mentioned last week, more machmir for the Shita of the Mordechai, that the Mordechai says grumma is mutter only b'mokom hefsid, when it's a great urgent need. But how do you define grumma? What's called a grumma? So this is going to be a big piece of it. So now Rav Soloveitchik has the following chiddush, and with this we'll close. Rav Shechter Shlita quotes from Rav Soloveitchik. He says, this is all true if you remove the dam and then the water comes out, but what if you set up the whole system to begin with? What if you set up like a Rube Goldberg? You know those things in the science center where you put the thing down and it goes over here and plunks the next thing and knocks the next thing and knocks the next thing. So what do you call that?
That's not grammar.
Why not?
Set it up.
Exactly. So that's the Chiddush of Rav Soloveitchik. He says, wait a second, it's only grumma when there's a pre-existing bucket of water and you open the spigot, you press the thing, or you take away the dam. But if you set it all up to begin with, he says that's not grumma. Others disagree, but it's all about this Magen Avraham to try to figure out what's called, it's also nafka min at the end of life. When a person, Rahman al-Islam is, doctors have these shilas, when a person is dying, well, is it called killing them, or is it just removing something that's standing in the way of them dying? This Magen Avraham plays an important role. Okay, we're going to stop here. And Amir Tashem.